Welcome back to the Dirty Inning.
We're back.
There he is.
All right. Hey, hi. I wanted you to do that one in full. It felt like we've been off for so long that I wanted you to really get it out of your system.
I wish we would have communicated on that.
That's kind of our other thing. We don't communicate. So right, now we're doing all the things that we usually do.
This is the first time you and I have actually spoken in about eight weeks. Just a cold silence.
Movie magic on the other episodes, we actually never speak. We're in two separate places, and one of us will send the other one the audio, and then the other one ad-libs content based on what the one person has said.
Yes, we have never met in person.
No, or spoken to each other until now.
Right.
I find this very unpleasant.
Yeah, we're changing up the formula this episode to get more of that warmth and chemistry that that our producers are telling us there needs to be more of. And I gotta say, so far, not liking it. Feeling like it wasn't the move. And
this isn't a Dirty Inning move,
right? This makes things something designed to make it more pleasant experience. Kind of goes against everything this podcast is about.
Truly gross.
It is about unpleasant experiences, and we should reflect that in our tone and relationship, which again is very bad.
Yeah, really bad. We're not friends. Justin, my friend, I wanted to dedicate this episode to something that is pleasant. Mr. Lenny Dykstra has been 20 months without being arrested.
Is that a legal milestone of some kind? Is he now permitted to leave the state or his house or the bathroom?
I think he's just really proud.
Mm.
He tweeted about it.
I wonder if he thinks that's like 2 years, 20 months.
He probably does. He probably thinks it's more important than 2 years because it's like two tens.
Right. I mean, how many more months could they put in a year? 10 just makes sense, you know?
And two tens is always how Lenny Dykstra describes his relationships.
Right.
Yeah.
Or his balls.
He has a podcast coming out with Aubrey Huff, so, you know, look out our podcast.
Are you serious? I did not know that. That
is politics.
Honestly, that's pretty cliche. That sucks.
Sorry. It's about politics and also like baseball snubs. And I think the first one's about how they are fools for not letting Schilling and Clemens and Bonds in.
Guys, before we go any further, I do have more to say on this. Before we go any further, I am Justin Clue of FanGraphs and Baseball Prospectus, and this is Dr. Trevor Strunk.
Hello.
Hi. We do this podcast called The Dirty Inning, in which we talk about the worst, dumbest, most obscure, funniest innings in Philadelphia Phillies history. We will not be talking about any particular inning on this arbitration-themed episode. But, you know, the general vibe of this podcast will remain the same. Now, just to circle back here real quick, Aubrey Huff and Lenny Dykstra hosting a podcast together. Aubrey Huff's little arc is really entertaining to me. He came out with that book about his recovery from, I guess, just, I don't know if he was, it was basically just being a dickhead.
Yeah, and like this book. Like, yeah.
Did this he, book did was he have basically an addiction
to like Adderall or what was it?
It was since I don't know, I'm not going to speculate, but a lot of it was like, oh, I used to be a big dickhead, but I'm not anymore. And then like around the time of the book coming out, he's like on Twitter being an Aubrey Huff dickhead on Twitter. And he just got this panicked call from his agent and was like, hey, man, we got like 60 trucks full of books. We got to sell. And nobody wants to like buy a dickhead's book. And he was like, oh, so he like wrote a hokey apology and got some articles written about himself. And then he just continued to be a dickhead on Twitter.
He can't help himself.
He's right.
Like, and now his whole thing is like Path of the Alpha.
Right.
He's like really into like MGTOW stuff. He's like, he's telling people how to become like good pickup artists. Very, very cool.
I assume that either has a new agent or the agent had like an epiphany moment where he was like, oh, okay, this like super aggro, hold my gun while I piss, never mind, I got it. Like that kind of brand is gonna fly. There's a demographic for everything, and that they know that there's a big one for that, and they can make a lot of money doing that. But you're right, there's a genuineness to his dickheadery that. That it does seem like this is not an act. It's truly.
Oh, no. I think he's incapable of being anyone but his horrible self.
And him and Dykstra, I mean, that'll be great.
I get the feeling that it's just for this one, but I also get the feeling because apparently Dykstra has a I gotta look it up because it is the most ridiculous name.
If it is popular, though, even if they're doing it once, if it is popular, they will do it again. If they do it again, someone will find a way to monetize it, and it will definitely be a thing.
Yep. This is just like, this is actually a, this is like a soft pilot, effectively. Oh, cool. So apparently he is starting a podcast. It's called Pawning Nails because he's launching
terrible, it. Terrible name. You guys could have done so much better.
Well, the reason is, Justin, he's launching it from a New Jersey pawn shop.
No. Still sucks.
And apparently some of the guests on tap are Artie Lang, Oil Can Boyd, and Anthony Scaramucci.
Yeah man. Are they going right from the Dancing with the Stars reject booth right to this podcast?
Yeah.
Are they just going to do it in the same, like they get escorted off the stage and into a booth where they have to record a podcast with Lenny Dykstra?
Yeah, this is amazing. Reese stressed the show would not be just about baseball, but we'll touch on a variety
You're kidding!
Of concepts.
I thought they were going to do deep statistical dives on the modern game. I thought that's so they're not going to stick to baseball. I'm floored by that. What else is there to talk about? That's crazy.
Wow, this is incredible. So I'm going to read a long passage from this article. You're going to thank me. Oil Can Boyd released snippets of the interview with Oil Can Boyd talking. On Monday, Dykstra and Reesus, who I guess is like one of the co-hosts, maybe? Oh, Daniel Reesus. He owns the Perfect Pawn chain in New Jersey. So him and a pawn chain operator, just like some real good Jersey vibes there, says they recorded a podcast for future airing in which they discussed a range of topics, including the escalating price of hot dogs at baseball stadiums.
I actually care very much about that topic, just for the record.
Okay, all right. And the Houston Astros alleged sign stealing. Naturally, the show features its often colorful language. I used to tell players, don't give me signs. I don't believe in signs, Dykstra said. That's like believing in effing spaceships. You couldn't relate science to the hitter fast enough.
I mean, did he just Johnny Cash science? Yeah. Don't give me rules, man. All I got are rules. Don't give me science. Don't give me. What are you talking about? Spaceships? Those things that we have and, and go to space in? That's like I reject it.
Dykstra also talked about spending $500,000 to hire private investigators to dig up dirt on umpires. Quote, when I realized how much power these umpires had over my life, I had private investigators follow them around. Remember, umpires' blood is just as red as yours or mine. Some of them like women, some of them like to gamble, some of them are gay. Dykstra said he used information the private investigators gave him to make sure the umpires showed him favoritism.
This is also bordering on cliche. It is so expected.
And then he says that's why he led the league in walks the next 2 years.
Wow.
And then finally, Reesus stressed the show will not just be about baseball, but will touch on a variety of other concepts, such as truth and redemption.
Okay, so it's the sport of baseball, and then whatever falls under the definition of these two ambiguous terms.
First off, the concept of truth, and then the theme of redemption. Totally amazing.
Well, with the off season in the state it's in, and so much of it still in front of us, I mean, it's really just a couple of weeks, like it's 3 weeks till. But like when pitchers and catchers report, it's a fun date, but nothing's really. There's no baseball as we understand it on our television screens, just because some guys show up to work in another state.
Pitchers and catchers is the worst day to me because like I get so excited about it, and like inevitably, like even after a year where it's like, ugh, I didn't care about baseball this year, like an off season where I'm like, it's kind of a depressing off season. Like pitchers and catchers, I'm immediately like, oh, sweet, it's pitchers and catchers. All right, I can't wait. And then like you realize nothing happens. You just get some tweets with what it's like. Jacob Realmuto is here.
You said Jacob Realmuto?
I slurred that name real bad.
If we're gonna masquerade as a Phillies podcast, we gotta do at least the minimum amount of research.
I don't know why I called him Jacob Realmuto. let's cycle back there and say Real Muto is here, and here's Nola. He's in here too, and they're all here, and they're getting to work, and we aren't privy to that. So, they're throwing bullpens or whatever.
Yeah, there's it's a velocity looking a little trimmer. Says he's ready to give 110%.
Best shape of his life. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. All that fun stuff. It's not really baseball. It is part of baseball, but then we really just get reports like that for about 2 weeks. Then the first spring training game happens, and we all tune in. And maybe like two innings in, it's like, I should read more, you know? Like, yeah. And so anyway. We love baseball here. The point is that there's still a decent amount of real estate on the calendar before even the first part of the season we don't care about. Love baseball, folks. I know I've been leaning hard into how much I hate certain aspects of it lately, but I do. It is my favorite sport. Love to tell its stories.
And as much as I don't know the name of the Phillies' best player, I love Bruce Harper.
Please stop. just...
Sorry, sorry. I got that one wrong, huh?
Well, the point is there's not a whole lot to talk about at this point. A lot of free agents are off the board. There's still some negotiating going on. I said there's not a whole lot to talk about. There's that going on. The fucking cheating scandal that's sport-wide going on.
All the weird accusations that people are saying, like Mike Trout has a secret... steroid.
All in all, you might say that there's a ton of stuff going on and many things to talk about.
I found out that Kevin Goldstein listens to No Cartridge.
Congratulations on something that happens to another podcast.
He might listen to The Dirty Inning. I mentioned it on No Cartridge.
Oh, well, look at that. We can do commercials right in the middle of the podcast.
That's right.
That's tremendous. I guess my point being, now that I've pivoted that transition to be something else entirely, is that among the other topics, kind of lost in the jungle of topics that there are to talk about baseball right now, because there are so many, as we're all saying, as everyone is saying.
People have been saying this all the time. Certainly no one said something different 4 minutes
People,
ago.
Stranger will stop me on the grab me aggressively by the arm and say it to my face.
Screaming at you
loudly, as if we are like intimate friends, and we are not like you and I. We are not either.
Oh no, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So among these topics is arbitration and contractual arbitration negotiations and debates and cases, and oh my gosh, it's so sexy and intriguing, and the Phillies actually have someone involved in arbitration this year. They couldn't settle on a number with all-star catcher JT Realmuto, whose name is JT Realmuto, as we've learned on this podcast, full of information.
Seems like maybe the worst member of your team to go to arbitration with.
It does. Now, as we've talked about, that when this first came up, that the Phillies couldn't pick a number with their catcher. They are going to, they're going to go to court over it. It sounds bad. And it sounds like this is one of the guys that you're like, boy, he's not even locked into an absolutely absurd, almost decade and a half contract and be imprisoned in this city forever. He actually needs to be convinced to stay here. And he said before, some typical quotes like, oh, hey, I would, if we can reach a number, we can, I'd love to be here. Basically, certainly open to the idea. Mm-hmm. This was the first attempt at finding a number, and they couldn't reach one, so they got to go to arbitration. Now you're probably wondering at this point what arbitration is and where it came from. And Trev, I'm pleased to say that an article on an old Angel Fire website, ooh, full of typos and various spinning rocket ship graphics, informed me that arbitration is named after an old Major League Baseball steamship on which players and team reps were once put and sent out onto international waters, ooh, where they were forced to hash out their contractual differences by any means necessary. And eventually they happened upon, they happened upon an island thought to be uninhabited, but discovered it contained a small group of humans who had never been contacted by society. Now, using their entirely pure objectivity, captivity, they let these natives act as third-party arbitrators in their negotiations, ensuring fairness. This process ended when the natives were instantly wiped out by a plague brought to their island by the baseball players, and the vessel was lost at sea when it got stuck between two rocks, one of which, you might say, was a hard place. Now, the league named the new process after the ship carrying its lost souls, and to this day, it's the most exciting and sexy part of the baseball calendar. So,
I mean, I'm laughing because it's so true.
Because of the accuracy in that statement. Yeah. Yes. So now the Phillies have gone to arbitration a shockingly low number of times, to the point that I still, you know, I checked this number and I read some old newspapers and by the time the Phillies were negotiating with Ryan Howard in 2008, they were 7-0 in arbitration hearings.
Ooh.
And that just seems like a very small number of times to go to arbitration. And,
but I mean, to be undefeated, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's something I want to talk about, actually.
Okay.
The first case for the Phillies when they went to arbitration was with Jerry Kuzman in 1985.
The immortal Jerry Kuzman.
Now, Trev, do you know when the first arbitration case in baseball took place?
Was that... it's not Curt Flood. Curt Flood is free agency. I don't.
I was hoping you did, because that's information I did not write down.
Well, you know what? I will look it up as you talk.
But that was something, an aspect of this I wanted to bring up, was that leafing through these old cases where the Phillies had to go to arbitration hearings with a series of players, where the player submits the amount of money they believe they are owed. The team submits a number they think is fair. If those numbers aren't the same and they can't reach an agreement, then they go to an arbitration hearing where an objective, I guess it's a council, or, you know, it's a judge's arbitration. I can't remember the word.
Well, so
basically three
arbiters.
Objective. Right. Arbitrator. Yeah. So three objective third parties hear both sides to the argument and decide what number the player will receive as their salary, essentially. Okay. And the first time this happened, Trev, was, I believe, in.
Holding.
Oh, I see. I assumed you were looking it up. I have been.
It's not easy to find. It's surprisingly difficult to find.
Well, the first time the Phillies did this, like, was with, as I said, Jerry Kuzman in 1985.
Okay.
Jerry Kuzman wanted $865,000 from the team. He was offered $600,000. Yeah, that's son of a. And and the Phillies thought he was worth slightly less than that. Kuzman was a pitcher for the Phillies in the mid-80s for 2 years, in 1984 and 1985. Right near the end of his career, he was 41. In 1984, he pitched 224 innings for them that year, made 34 starts at 41 years old. So going into 1985, he felt like he was maybe owed a little more. And boy, it didn't really pay off. He had a 4.62 ERA in 18 starts, and then he never played Major League Baseball again. But an Inquirer writer had referred to the arbitration process at this point as one of, quote, untidy mudslinging. So there was a reputation for the process already. Nobody likes arbitration, Phil's vice president Tony Siegel said. Arbitration forces you to settle. Now, there was some stickiness.
Wow.
There was some stickiness to presenting a young player with all of his faults right in front of him to determine what his amount of money, you know, his life was worth. And it was considered a bad place to find yourself in,
people,
you know, they have the varied human tendency to harbor bitterness, you might think. But Kuzman was, again, he was in his 40s at the time. And after a 4.5-hour hearing in New York, he lost. And the Phillies pointed out how guys like Pete Rose and Tony Perez, part of their argument had been, you know, look at Pete Rose, look at Tony Perez. They were about the age of Jerry Kuzman. They started to decline around the same, you know, the same age that he is now.
That's kind of rough.
They didn't mention any of the good things they wrote about me in the media guide, Kuzman told reporters, which is very funny that the team obviously is writing flattering things in a publication that they are writing. And then the team turns around and is like, well, is he that good, though, now that we have to pay him? Kuzman said he considered it just another loss, only a more expensive one. Said that he'd get over all the things the Phillies had said about him, quote, in about 10 years. But assumed he was joking. Of course, you get asked if this will impact you on the field once you lose an arbitration case to your team. And of course you say no, Kuzman said the comments about his body declining were kind of a, quote, slap in the face to the Phillies training staff with whom he'd worked to stay in shape, which that's fair. That's a fair statement, too. If he's gone out of his way to, like, work with these specific trainers to get in shape, and then the Phillies are like, well, he's not in great shape, and we're going to pay him less because of that. He can say that. I mean, you know, if that, even if that's him just being like, I'm going to sow some discontent here because I didn't get what I wanted, that's still, I think, a valid argument.
I wanted to add, I think what's really interesting about what you're saying, like, as I'm looking up stuff about the history of arbitration and when it started, the history of arbitration is like, it came about as this basically something that the players wanted. It was a heavy sort of player win when it happened in 1973, and it solved a lockout. And apparently, Ted Simmons refused to sign a contract and threatened to take a salary to an arbitrator after the season. And then apparently they set some ground rules with salary arbitration, and that was all they wrote. So 73 was the first one. Ted Simmons is kind of sort of the first guy, but it's also complicated, right? Like, even from the start of the history, it's just this weird nebulous mess of, like, you know, oh, you know, who's at fault? Who's benefiting from this? Who's, like, who's the jerk here? Who is, like, you know, are you, when you say something bad about me, are you actually, like, helping yourself or hurting yourself? It is just such a, like, a non, it's not conducive to rational thinking.
So much of this is not, you could argue. By the way, Ted Simmons going into the Hall of Fame this year, he was inducted not too long ago. He'll be going in with Derek Jeter, Larry Walker, and Marvin Miller.
Is he going in with the favoritism squad? Is the Veterans Committee vote him in the way we like? Is it collusion?
I'm not sure if it was full on cronyism, I believe this is the situation where cronyism was birthed, because he was voted in balloting by the Hall of Fame's Modern Baseball Era Committee. So it's one of the committees that voted him in. Is where, I believe, this is where our favorite concept in baseball,
cronyism,
a bunch of dudes hanging out on a committee who are like, you know what we should do is get that guy we like who sucked but we liked him and we all played together into the Hall of Fame. And then it because they have the power to do that. But that is not him.
Okay.
What happened here. Yeah.
He should be in the Hall of Fame for creating arbitration.
Exactly. That alone. So it's a very important process. It's something that's probably going to get, looked at, remeasured potentially. You know, moving forward, it's one of the key components to players. What would we say? Rights, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, I think so. That's it. Arbitration is a right of the player.
And so, does that make it a good thing that the Phillies have had so few cases like this?
I think it's hard to say. Like, this is the hard thing about arbitration, right? Where, like, it. So, like, Real Muto has also said, like, the stuff you normally say about arbitration, where he's like, oh, no, it's fine. Like, I'm not mad at the Phillies. Like, this is just kind of what happens. And he's like, I'm aiming for higher because, like, catchers don't do well in arbitration. So we'll see what happens. And it's like a game. But in a perfect world, that would be right, right? Where you just say, like, yeah, I'm going to arbitration to see if I can, like, get a better salary for myself that I think I deserve. And I think I have a good argument. But I think also it's so aggressive and, like, antagonistic in a sport that really you have to salve the egos of your players, that it's probably good for the team and for the players themselves to not go to arbitration. So, like, as a labor theorist, I would say, yeah, it's always good to go to arbitration, so it's bad the Phillies haven't. As a Phillies fan and a baseball fan, I would probably say, like, I don't know, maybe it's just better for everyone if you just come to a contract before arbitration.
So does it not mean, and granted, you know, I'm never going to be the one to give any corporate entity the benefit of the doubt about anything, but does it not also say that the Phillies are more willing to give players what players want?
Yeah,
that
probably.
That they aren't going to arbitration?
Probably,
I mean,
yeah.
I don't, saying that out loud, I don't feel like the Phillies have that reputation, but they, you know, clearly the numbers say something different.
Well, they're not known as like a trial and file team, right? Or a file and trial team, right? Like, where it's like, there are teams like that. Like, I think the Rays are that way, where, like, if you say you want arbitration, if you file numbers, they're just like, all right, we're going to trial. There's no, we're not going to sign a contract now. This is going to arbitration. I don't think the Phillies have that reputation, at least not like openly. But I mean, it could be that they're just known to play hardball, and like they're willing to trade you and stuff, because that's certainly a reputation the Phillies have. Willing to trade any player that they don't want on their team anymore for money or attitude reasons.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I'm not sure they have that reputation either. I think just having such a close look, or taking such a close look at the Phillies all the time, you just start seeing patterns, and I'm just like, oh yeah, so am I crediting the Phillies with like deft negotiation powers over the years? And I don't know, just for some reason that stuck out at me as something to be like, well, are they? But you know, clearly, whatever it means to go 7-0 in your arbitration cases, the Phillies
had done that
by 2008. And I want to bring up a component to this in a second, but first we're going to bring up our first commercial break, so we'll talk more about the Phillies in arbitration right after this break. So Trev, talking about the Phillies and arbitration cases from their history, currently they're at least destined to have currently an arbitration hearing with star catcher JT Realmuto. They couldn't reach a number both sides thought he was worth paying, and now they're going to have to hash it out in front of God and, you know, three objective third parties. And, you know, this is...
As we've learned from Lenny Dykstra, no one's objective, baby. Realmuto should be spending $500,000 to investigate their sex lives, and then he'll get his arbitration case.
He should be driving around in a convertible full of champagne. Like loose champ, like it's floating. It's like up to his shoulders, bottles.
I think most people should model their careers after Lenny Dykstra.
Sure.
Yeah. Why not?
See how long you last. It's called the Lenny Dykstra 20 challenge.
Months. It's
like the ice bucket challenge, but living like Lenny Dykstra as long as you can.
It's a horrible challenge.
Well, reading about arbitration, and I feel like I was beginning this point before the break, so let me finish it here. Reading about all these old cases of arbitration, and I feel like coverage of this topic has changed over time. There's a lot of language that makes it sound like it is its own sport. Like, for instance, they listed the Phillies' arbitration results as a record, which is why I was able to say they were 7-0. And they use words like, "Oh, the Phillies defeated their player in an arbitration hearing," and like it's like wins and losses. Early on, the media seems a little wary of this process. I think there's an element of like, this is the business of the game, not the, you know, the magic of the summer's eve with the game happening in front of us. There was confusion. There was characterization, and you know, I don't know. It just feels like that probably didn't do a lot for player and team relations to see this stuff get covered that way. I think this day and age, you see a lot more of players, you know, you still see them being, you know, I think the press is working that angle still, just because it's a more dramatic angle to track. But I think you'll most of the time hear what JT Realmuto said, which was basically, it's just business. It's not me versus the Phillies. Like, this is part of the baseball. And he's actually gone out of his way to say, oh, I'm, you know, I want to set the bar for catchers. I want to like make history here and sort of set the market on the guys who play my position, because, you know, that was something he feels he needs to be done. So,
I mean, honestly, like if he is being completely honest, then I mean, who knows, right? Like, I don't know him personally. I don't know if he's like a super straightforward guy, if like he's like whatever, like maybe he's being honest, maybe not. But like,
I would say, just to jump in, I would say, based on what we learned about him when he was traded here,
he is your best friend.
There was a profile of him, I think, back when he was in high school, and he was like this huge, huge baseball star in his community. And a reporter came to profile him and saw his room and was just like, yeah, like organized to a T, like just everything in its place, sock drawer, vacuum, desk, you know, everything. The drawers are closed, the closet's shut, bed is made, you know. So yeah. I would... based on that and you know, other things you just know about him because of his reputation, I would be surprised if JT Realmuto was anything other than a pretty straightforward guy.
So I mean, if he is being straightforward, and it seems to me that you're right, like he is that way, I think, you know, he's saying the things that are right about his position as like a worker, right? Like, you should be interested in upping your, you know, max number because that helps everyone. Like, that's the actual rising tide that lifts all boats. If you, like, say, well, now this is the top catcher thing, so even the bad catchers will get more money in, or even, like, the mid-tier catchers, for that matter, will get more money in arbitration than they would before. I think that's cool. I also think it's true that, like, if he's saying, like, it's not personal and, like, this is just what it is, but I'll make my case and try to win this, that's also probably the healthiest possible way to approach arbitration. I don't think a lot of people do, because baseball players are psychos. I think probably they approach it as, like, a huge personal affront and they get mad. And, I mean, most owners are psychos, too, so it's not like they're innocent in this either.
But most owners are psychos. Yeah. I would totally agree with that.
Yeah. But if in fact, JT Real Muto is approaching it this way, then good on him. That is the healthiest way you could do it.
I would. Yes. Like I said, I'm assuming that that he is. He wanted $12.4 million from the Phillies. The Phillies said, how about $10 million? They don't. According to Jim Salisbury, people with inside knowledge of this are kind of like, no, they're probably not going to reach a settlement. Mm-hmm. So within the first 2 weeks of February out in Arizona, they will have a hearing heard by a panel, and one of the two sides will be chosen. And the historic nature of this is that this is going to be a one-year deal, obviously, based on Real Muto's contract, and it could set the record for a one-year deal, with many people assuming that it will. So that is what he's looking to do.
Cool.
As far as history goes. And that's, you know, essentially what arbitration is. Did we really define it in there somewhere? I mean, I have the ML. Do you think, just for safety's sake, we're 40 minutes into the episode on arbitration.
I think people know what arbitration is now. You know what? If not, Wikipedia describes arbitration as. It's legal labor. It's basically like, if you don't want to have a strike, but you also don't think you can come to terms with your boss about your salary, arbitration is the middle thing that you do. Like, I've been through arbitration when I was in my grad school union. It's not like, it's not very interesting. You just talk to an arbitrator as opposed to your grad school people. The only thing was, my arbitrator didn't have the ability to determine our contracts. That's the only hitch in baseball, because they didn't want to have it be like, then you'll talk to an arbitrator. If you don't like that, you can file for strike. Like, they probably didn't want to give them that option. So let's not encourage the strike thing. So, yeah, I mean, that's the only difference in baseball, as far as I can tell, from, like, if you're in a union, what you will someday maybe have, where, like, you just talk to some other person and say, like, my boss says this about me, but I think this. And then your boss says, well, I think this about him. And then you kind of just, they pick a side.
Flip the table over and walk out.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Power move. Well, the next guy, as we said, Jerry Kuzman was the first Phillies player to go to an arbitration hearing in 1985. The next year, they did it again with Alan Nicely, but this was far less covered. Alan Nicely played in, I think, like 6 or 7 games for the Phillies total.
Huh.
He was a pretty far down reserve catcher who they apparently could not come to a number with. Yeah, he played 7 games for the Phillies in 1985 at 30 years old. He went 0-for-7 at the plate with 4 strikeouts.
I like the stones on this guy for wanting to go to arbitration after the, like, the Phillies are like, here's a contract. I'm like, no.
He does that, and he wants $140,000. He was offered $80,000. I'm sorry. I might have said that in the wrong order. I think he came from another team. He came from the Reds, then went to arbitration hearing with the Phillies, then had that season of essentially nothingness.
Oh, well, that, okay, that makes
that
sense.
That would make a lot more sense.
That's a and very Phillies outcome.
That is what happened, yeah. Okay. So, given his low profile, the hearing was not widely covered and listed only as the Phillies' second straight victory in arbitration, which brings us to 1987, when they did it for the third time in the third year in a row.
Man.
This time with Kevin Gross.
Oh, I know him.
Yes. He wanted $525,000. He was offered $450,000. Now, the Phillies had avoided arbitration with Gross the previous year, who had been viewed as their best pitcher during a rather forgettable season. Gross had the league lead in home runs surrendered with 28. That little pause there really made you think it was something else.
Huh? Yeah, that's not good.
Most home run giving upping.
Yikes.
In playing of baseball suckily. Yes.
He did great at that. He did great at being bad.
He gave up 28 home runs, so the Phillies were ready to throw that stat in his face. The hearing took place in a hotel suite with Phillies VP Tony Siegel and frequent consultant for, I think, multiple teams, Tal Smith, the former Houston player for whom Tal's Hill was named at Minute Maid Park in Houston, that meaningless bump in the outfield that...
meaningless?
Yes, meaningless. Why, was he buried under there?
Yeah, he was.
Was he?
Yeah.
We better check and see.
No, he was not buried under there, Justin. I was kidding.
I meant he is not dead, so that is not even
so, I thought you were checking. I was like, no.
With Tal Smith next to him, Phillies VP Tony Siegel went to work against Kevin Gross. The negotiations were drama-free, according to all the parties present, and the arbitrator, whose name was Arvid Anderson... Which I suppose I wrote down because...
How would you ever remember it?
It's Arvid Anderson, which sounds like the first character in a children's book about the alphabet, ruled in favor of the Phillies.
Well, that's a shame. I think Kevin...
Well, that's a shame. Brilliant. So then the next time the Phillies went to arbitration wasn't till 1991. So they had a nice 4-year break where there weren't any arbitration hearings. Pricing is taking a little bit of a jump here. We have our first $1 million negotiation with Dickie Thon.
Oh, okay.
Who wanted $1.7 million. He was offered $1.25 million. Now, there were a lot of thoughts and words in the air during arbitration in 1991. Barry Bonds had emerged as a prolific talent in Pittsburgh. And you know how people like to view superstars who want to get paid fairly and reasonably.
Yeah, just like the really good guys they are.
Right. Everyone says, hey, he deserves to get what he is owed as set by the market price. And no one is like, hey, he has more money than me. Let's kill him.
I like this new character that we came up with.
Well, Bonds was being, I'll say, straightforward with his demands. He wanted a 5-year deal. He wanted it to be worth $20 million. He wanted $3 million right now without going to arbitration. And he said if that wasn't going to happen, the Pirates should, quote, do me a favor and trade me. He said that if the owners felt they couldn't afford him, they should sell the team to someone who could. And he said that he would leave Pittsburgh and that he would, quote, haunt the Pirates if that should occur.
And so he did.
I was going to say, and he was not wrong.
Absolutely 1,000,000% correct.
So in less verbose negotiations in Philadelphia, Dickie Thon was up for arbitration. In 1989, the Phillies had settled with Thon 45 minutes before his arbitration hearing had been scheduled for a 1-year salary of $450,000, according to the Associated Press. No such luck in 1991 when GM Lee Thomas had reportedly, quote, little hope for the Phillies to avoid arbitration with the shortstop.
Rough.
Thon, Jason Stark wrote in the Inquirer, wanted a long-term deal and he would be, quote, hurt enough not to receive one that he would demand a trade the following year. So what actually wound up happening was the Phillies just did not offer him a salary arbitration. And
Listen, that is one way to do it.
They allowed their shortstop to become a free agent by just not offering salary arbitration, and he wound up signing as a free agent with the Rangers.
How did you do there?
Great question. By this point in his career, you know, Dickie Thon is 34 years old, so he hit .247. He slugged .367. He made it into 95 games, and then he played another year. In 1993, he was still in the league. He was 35 years old playing for the Brewers, that's one of those generational touching guys where he's like from the 70s, but he played in the 90s. Like,
it's pretty cool that I admire him to do it, but it's pretty crazy that he asked for a long term deal after all. I want to be in with the Phillies for at least 5 years. I'm out of the league by 1993. Like,
well, that was Bonds who wanted the 5.
Well, I guess I'm conflating them because he said he wanted a long term deal. But
yeah,
still.
You threw me off there. I was like, wait, what the hell?
No, yeah, I guess maybe he just wanted 2 or 3 years. In which case, fine.
Stark, in a column with some pro-owner slant, characterized the situations stirred up by Bonds and Thawne as creating, quote, clout where none exists. Players who perhaps ridiculously, this part is not a quote. He's talking about players who perhaps ridiculously tried to get what they wanted were viewed through the lens of smirking patronization. You could just tell in the coverage of these events. And that's what I'm talking about. This has really changed over the years. Trev, how do you pronounce the name of that old Cubs manager named Dale?
Sveim.
Dale Sveim is the next arbitration case.
I didn't even realize he was a Philly. That's funny.
Yeah, they had a 3-0 record at this point, what Trev and I are calling a technical victory in with Dickie Thawne in 1991. Not quite fair to give him full credit for that one, but history does anyway. But yeah, Dale Sveim at age 28 played in 54 games for the Phillies in 1992. He also switched teams that year to go to the White Sox in 1993. He was with Oakland. The next year he was with Seattle. So he was in kind of a transient phase of his career. Sveim had run into a wall and broken his leg playing for the Brewers in 1988.
Thanks.
He missed all of 1989 with tendonitis. The Phillies traded for him in December 1991 in exchange for Bruce Ruffin and wound up trading him to the White Sox the following August for Keith Shepard. But in between, they had a little debate about his salary. Ed Wade thought Sveim was worth about a $40,000 raise, and Sveim wanted slightly more than that. He wanted $720,000. The Phillies offered him $375,000.
Oh boy.
So this is probably one of the most far apart cases. In the 1991 season, he hit .241 with a .685 OPS. I could list some other stats here, but he did not win that arbitration case.
No, I mean, that seems like one that is a little tricky to win. Good for him. Again, as always, good for him for trying. Bring him to court. Don't let him pull you down.
Speaking of good for him for trying, I feel like I was going to say this case is good. It's always interesting to see the player be like, I want this much money just to see, like, maybe I can get it. But the next case is a case of that nature as well. It doesn't happen until 1996 when the Phillies took on Willie Banks at an arbitration hearing. And we'll get to that right after this break. Well, we're back talking about the Phillies and their history of arbitration.
And Wilson Willie Banks.
Oh, yeah, Willie Banks. In 1996, the Phillies had won, five arbitration
cases?
This is five,
yeah. So far, they're 4-0, yeah. Including forfeit in every three.
They beat Jerry Kuzman in 1985, Alan Nicely in 1986, Kevin Gross in 1987, a technical victory against Dickie Thawne in 1991, Dale Sveim in 1992. So they've won five straight. They are 5-for-5 in arbitration cases.
I totally forgot about Kevin Gross in there. Yeah, 5-for-5. Wow.
Yep. Willie Banks was next in 1996. He wanted $560,000. The Phillies offered him $240,000. That was the same as his previous year's salary.
Oh, see, that's not very nice.
The Phillies were doing something.
Yeah, that's that's kind of a... Man, that's mean. It's just mean.
Yeah, you know, hey, it's a nasty business. The Phillies selected Willie Banks off waivers on October 4th, 1995. They picked him up from the Florida Marlins. He was released by the Phillies on March 8th, 1996. So he lasted into the new year and into early March. But I don't believe he has any, like, stats for the Phillies. So I believe they just had him for a minute. Yeah, he did not actually, I think, suit up for the Phillies and produce stats.
Wow, I wonder why after the way they treated him.
Yeah, so in 1996, the year this happened, baseball owners had tried to abolish the arbitration system leading up to this season. Banks, who had been claimed off waivers the previous season, asked for almost $600,000, as I said, something the Philadelphia Daily News called, quote, one of history's more outrageous arbitration filings.
Hmm.
So Banks loses and has to take the $240,000 the Phillies offered him. Nobody really thought twice about the situation until March 8th, when Willie Banks was throwing before a scheduled spring training start. Jim Fregosi notices this guy Banks isn't throwing with anything close to big league velocity. And he's like, what's the deal, friend? You hurt?
Incredible.
And Banks is like, oh, yeah, definitely. I have had this problem since I was with the Twins, and it's only gotten worse. And I basically, like, can't pitch.
Incredible.
And upon investigating, along with a medical doctor, Fregosi later told reporters on Banks, quote, all the muscles in his upper arm are gone.
Excuse me?
He did not play in Major League Baseball or Minor League Baseball in 1996, but he came back in 97. He was with the Yankees.
Wow.
In 98, he was with the Yankees.
He rope-a-doped him.
Went to the Diamondbacks, didn't play in 99 or 2000, comes back in 2001 at age 32.
Incredible.
Shows up in 5 games for the Red Sox, comes back in 2002 at 33, shows up in 29 games with the Red Sox. So he made a career out of it, but that was a particularly funny moment. Banks now coaches at the Toms River Sports Academy in Toms River, New Jersey.
Good for him, man. That's like a... Yeah. That's a story of being very, I want to say, like, crafty. Crafty is the word. Like, people talk about crafty lefties all the time, or, like, you know, like, oh, that doesn't have a lot of velocity, but he can trick you with his pitches. Very rarely do you see someone trick a team into giving them a contract.
I guess it was a case of, he was like, I'm going to ask for $560,000, and they're going to, you know, they're going to give it to me or not. I will convince a panel to give it to me or not.
Right, exactly.
So amazing. The next case didn't happen for another 5 years, and this one was with everybody's nonchalant first baseman, Travis Lee, in 2001. Travis Lee wanted $1.6 million. The Phillies were like, we'll give you half that. And they offered him $800,000. There were, by the time of Lee's arbitration hearing in 2001, still 48 players in arbitration, which was a new record. Before the 1994 season, which had a labor stoppage, you may remember, there had been 16 players in arbitration, which was a new record at that point, according to the Allentown Morning Call. But again, wow, there were now 48. So that's what, 3 times the previous record? Travis Lee hit .235 and 404 at bats for the Phillies. One thing you notice about the language around, well, I said this, around arbitration is how it pits owners and players against each other as though the hearing itself is a sport. This is a case of that happening again. In the case of Travis Lee in 2001, one headline even literally read, owners 1, players 0.
Ooh.
And I think every mention of Lee's particular case mentioned the Phillies' 7-0 record in arbitration cases.
And that is so grim. That's extremely dark. Current reporting is bad, but boy, that is much, much worse.
Yeah, sports coverage has evolved in ways as we talk about often on this show. Like there's always that, like, in cases of topics where people don't realize, oh, you know, let's take this seriously, or, you know, aren't aware of how things are going to evolve. This used to be something I think writers could be a little cheekier about, but now it is something that a lot of people take a little more seriously because they realize,
yeah,
there's a lot attached to this. Bob Brookover referred to the Phillies and Lee's agent, who was Scott Boras, as, quote, arbitration heavyweights in the debate over Lee's worth. Brookover wrote that the Phillies' 6-0 record leading up to this case was on the line. The silence between the two parties was deafening. Anybody familiar with Lee's time in Philadelphia will be not surprised to learn that he was not communicating with the Phillies throughout this process. They had his number, but Ed Wade told reporters that, quote, there just basically hasn't been any communication. Wade mentioned he could tell from pretty early goings that this particular case wouldn't be very forthcoming in its exchanges. In 2007, Lee asked for an unconditional release from the Nationals because he just, like, didn't want to play baseball anymore.
Yikes.
Which was unrelated, but I always am entertained that he was, by the end of his career, he was just like, eh, all right, I'm out.
I'd like an unconditional release. Reason? Don't want to play no more. Want to go home.
I don't know if he literally listed that as the reason, which he most assuredly did not, but, like, that's the vibe you got from Travis Lee. He was like, I just kind of want to go home.
I still wish he would beat the Phillies, but Ed Wade versus Travis Lee. I know it wasn't really Ed Wade versus Travis Lee, but that's the most aw shucks arbitration I can think of.
Well, speaking of aw shucks arbitration, Trev, this is our last case, and it was our most recent, I believe.
I think again, I know what this one is.
Yeah, this was against Ryan Howard in 2008.
The Sultan of SWAT.
One of the more critical ones for the Phillies. He wanted $10 million. He was offered $7 million. And as I've repeatedly said, the Phillies were 7-0 in arbitration hearings by 2008 and hadn't been to one in 7 years until Ryan Howard in 2008 beat them for a record-breaking $10 million, which made him the second-highest paid Phillies player behind who? Do you think at this point 2008 roster?
2008 roster. Adam Eaton.
Wrong.
Chase Utley.
Wrong.
I don't know who. Pat Burrell.
Pat Burrell. Yeah, was making $14 million that year, and all Ryan Howard had done by this point is win Rookie of the Year and MVP while mashing just shy of 150 home runs. In 2007, he'd made $900,000.
Hmm.
I mean, you know, he hadn't won all that stuff yet, but it's just still...
It's a little crazy.
Yeah, he was considered a bargain, I think, at the early stages of his career.
Even for the 2008, million, I think you'd pay $10 million for even late stage Ryan Howard.
The 2008 offseason...
But...
yeah, well, yeah, not, we don't talk about those times. The 2008 offseason saw Howard put on a green suit covered in little golf ball sized sensors to be motion captured for MLB The Show because he was going to be on the cover.
Neat.
But Howard was wearing a slick pinstriped suit when he rolled up to the Vinoy Hotel and Resort in St. Petersburg for his arbitration hearing in February 2008.
He should have been wearing the motion capture suit.
I wish he had shown up in the motion capture. This is a power move. I don't know how, but it's, you know, powerful. He asked, "How do I look?" And according to Scott Lauber of the News Journal, an onlooker replied, "Like $1 million." pretty cool.
Very cool. Did he then give him $1 million?
Here you go. Here's 1/10 of what I think I'm worth.
Yeah, you skip. Good joke.
Tal Smith was again consulting, as was his job at the time. He maintained it had not been, quote, contentious, but you could tell reporters were eager to find out if anything dramatic was said between the Phillies and their young slugging star.
I'll kill you.
If any knives were drawn, bottles smashed and wielded menacingly. They truly believed these proceedings would lead to a fracture between the player and the team, but history kind of showed that even if it did, people on either side seemed content to not let it be public. The numbers were on the owner's side, not Howard's numbers, mm-hmm. which were big and cool, but the historic numbers. By this point in time, the Inquirer said, owners had won 57.8% of all arbitration hearings. Jimmy Rollins said once Howard beat the Phillies and got his $10 million, Rollins said finally his old roommate could pay him back for some of the expenses he had incurred. He also expected Howard to buy an Aston Martin DB9, which cost about $170,000 because he had seen the car in the James Bond movie Casino Royale apparently just fallen in love with the car. And Rollins said Howard had been eyeing it up for about a year, and that money was now, quote, chump change to him.
It shouldn't be. That's wow.
I mean, yeah, you're a young player. You're at the top of your game. You get paid that much money. You see a car in a movie, and you're like, I'm gonna buy that car.
I'm gonna buy James Bond's car.
You know, in movies like in Batman Begins and other movies where like a billionaire comes into a restaurant and they're like, "You can't do that." And he's like, "I just bought your restaurant." Impossible. You know, that cannot happen. Seeing a car in a movie and then buying that car, probably about as close as you can get to doing that in real life.
That would be kind of, I mean, like, I don't like billionaires, but I do like the idea of going into a restaurant and being like, "I just bought your restaurant. Make me a grilled cheese."
Now, grilled cheese for everyone.
Sir, this like, is the finest restaurant in Philadelphia.
I said, make me a grilled cheese!
Slam more money on the table.
And just, break a pan over the chef's head. Yeah. Like, got any more heroes? Anybody else?
Now I'm just...
Grilled cheese. Now I'm, everybody.
Now I'm going to get attacked by Batman instead of being Batman.
Well, asking fans about the results of Howard's win in arbitration was about as fruitful as you'd imagine. Some people said he was worth it. Some people worried about the cost of concessions now that the Phillies had a $10 million player. some people said he should have been happy at $7 million. They just wanted to see Howard get a multi-year deal after this so they could have him on the team his whole career.
Careful what the monkey's paw curls.
Uh-huh. As one person put it, either way, Howard can't leave the Phillies unless they trade him until 2011. That was at first written in this column. And then someone said, if the Phillies can't sign him to an extension, there could be a team like the Yankees waving millions and millions of dollars at him. I hope that doesn't happen, but you never know. And as we all know, Howard eventually got his extension, and everyone was happy about it, and no one ever talked about it again. The end.
Now he's on the Wall of Fame, and everyone loves him.
Yeah, now that he's not here at the tail end of a not even a tail end the several years at the end of it, you know what, we're gonna talk about that arbitration
really.
That this has been your arbitration episode of the Dirty Inning. We get to go back in time and just scramble through case after case of arbitration in the Phillies history. If I somehow read something wrong and someone's like, excuse me, there were like way more than
we learned something in the actual recording of this episode. I don't know if that's ever happened before.
Oh, it happens all the time. And let's say that if it's the case that I read some sort of list wrong, then we'll just say we told you the story of 7 arbitration cases in Phillies history. But it's such a low number.
It's surprising. It really is. Yeah. I mean, like, I don't know, especially considering that the Phillies don't have like a particularly good record, like a good relationship with players record. Like you think about your JD Drews and your et cetera's, Scott Rowland's, your Curt Schillings,
Travis Lee.
Travis Lee's just like, can I leave?
To play anymore.
Oh no, Travis.
You get back out there and you hate this dumb sport. Love baseball. Can't stress that
baseball's
enough.
Baseball's good.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to the arbitration episode of The Dirty
Inning.
Justin,
I think I speak for everyone when I say thanks for bringing it to us.
Of course. It is my, I'm making finger quotes, pleasure to do so. To my nearest and closest friend and confidant, Trevor Stark.
Hello.
To whom I enjoy speaking directly. We got plenty more Dirty Inning content coming at you over the course of the winter. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all of your favorite Phillies podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rozier, and this podcast, of course, The Dirty Inning with me and Dr. Trevor Strunk. We've also got a Patreon, patreon.com/hit and season. Tons of new stuff going up on there all month long, and you get access to it for $5. So, now, with a head full of arbitration knowledge and stories, go forth into the winter and let's hope the JT Realmuto arbitration hearing sees a productive and quick end.
I think it probably
for all parties
will.
Involved. I think it probably will too.
Yeah, I'm not all that worried about that one. I think it's gauche of the Phillies to let it get there, but I also don't think they're going to lose a player out of it.
Yeah, we go into the rest of the winter full of optimism, our hearts smiling. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on The Dirty Inning.
Talk to you then.